Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on X, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. And friends, it is a special day this week. It's the first week in January. And that is the anniversary of Film Sociology. It was the first weekend in January of 2009. I always remember Ed Johnsonat was my guest. Frost Nixon was the big film. So I guess we are now year 15, going into year of Film Sociology. So happy anniversary. Thanks to everybody who's been a part of this over the years, and especially you, the listener, and you, the people who post online for Grab a Pencil, which we will do. We're going to do an extra long version this week because of technical difficulties we did not have last week's show. Sorry about that. So, and if I happen to read yours twice by mistake, that happens. So anyway, keep watching good movies. That's what this show is all about. So thank you. All right. I've put this off as long as I can. I'll probably have a longer breakdown of this on the Medium Cool podcast, but it's the first weekend in January, and I guess I'm obligated to give my best of the year, best films for 2023. Going through, I like to look at the stuff that didn't make the list, and that means it's a pretty strong year. Films like Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Blackberry, You Hurt My Feelings, Asteroid City, Barbie, Jules, Dumb Money, Eileen, Biosphere, All of Us Strangers, The Color Purple, All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt, probably the most hypnotic film of the year, even though it didn't make my top 10. So, pretty good, strong honorable mentions. Here we go. At number 10, the tense drama How to Blow Up a Pipeline from director Daniel Goldhaber. Just a ragtag group just trying to, all with one common goal, and that's to blow up, to basically do the title of the film. But they all have their own methods and their own methodologies and their own psyches. And that is more tense, I think, than the are they actually going to pull the job off or not? Number 9 is Sofia Coppola's Priscilla. Really good performance from Kaylee Spani, if I hope I'm saying that right, as Priscilla, and Jacob Elordi as E. Not Baz Luhrmann's Elvis film, I assure you. And this film also gave me the biggest laugh of the year. The use of I Will Always Love You by Dolly Parton at the end of the film. Number 8, we have a tie because it's my list. And I tend to lump them together for certain reasons. Number 8 is Anatomy of a Fall, as well as The Zone of Interest, because of the performance, especially in Anatomy of a Fall, of Sandra Hüller. Really strong performances in both films. But as I said, especially in Anatomy of a Fall, a film that you just don't know where it's going. And The Zone of Interest from Jonathan Glazer, the family living outside a death camp during the Holocaust, and trying to have a regular family life while all these atrocities are going on right outside their doors. Number 7, Poor Things. Yep, that was the IFJA winner. Visually stunning. I pat myself on the back because I got to show the film, The Favorite, to my family before they watched Poor Things. Really fun performances from Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo, especially Willem Dafoe. Number 6, Robot Dreams. This is the film not enough people have seen or will see, and you can keep the Spider-Verse. I'll keep this world where animals and their robots love and live in New York City. Number 5 is Naiad. This was the most tense I think I was all year watching this with my favorite movie couple this year, Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. from directors Jeremy Chin and Elizabeth Chai Vasseri, the couple that gave us Free Solo, which I was just as tense watching this, and this was a fictional film. So it's really strong. Number four, Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. If anything else, say what you will about the length of the film. I understand. Deal with it. I did. But never forget Lily Gladstone in this film. Yes, we see a lot of DiCaprio with his jaw shoved way forward, and De Niro gets to do his Trump impression to a certain degree. But I was up for more of this film, as well edited as is the great Thelma Schumacher's. Her birthday was this past week. It's like Goodfellas, but not as smart. The participants aren't as smart as the gang in Goodfellas. And if it gets more people talking about the novel and that piece of history, it's easy for old straight white guy to say this, then so be it. But don't forget Lily Gladstone. She is one of the top performances of the year, holding her own with the likes of De Niro and DiCaprio around her. Number three is Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, the fastest three-hour film I've seen. And that's saying a lot. Got to see it on the biggest screen possible, and it moves. It really moves. And I still love that the most tense aspect is not whether the bomb goes off or not, but the reaction from the people to celebrate what they have just done as far as changing history. Number two, Celine Song's Past Lives. It's always great when there's a film early in the year that just holds on and becomes a part of the list. Excellent performance from Greta Lee. That's another one hopefully folks won't forget. A love triangle that we've not seen in films. Not like this. I think you know, it would be quaint if it was a British remake. It would be dumb if it was an American remake. But in this aspect of somebody from your past life that almost connected, and it's a great question. This is a great cinematic question of, is the grass greener on the other side? And this was just as tense as something like NIAID and how to blow up a pipeline, and it's all emotional, so really strong. And yes, my number one film this year, Alexander Payne's The Holdovers. It looks like a 70s film. I love Alexander Payne's work. Excellent performances from Paul Giamatti, from Divine Joy Randolph, who will hopefully get some recognition, and for Jacob Elordi, who gets to hold, not Jacob Elordi, Dominic Sessa, who gets to bounce off Giamatti and Randolph in this really fun 70s film about family. And it takes a village, and in this case, a cook and a teacher who's stuck over Christmas break to raise a child. And if you watch this film, if you're a fan of The Graduate, Five Easy Pieces, The Last Detail, those pictures, which I am, it's a lovely Valentine to those pictures. And we've also had those. My wife and I have brought in, you know, holiday orphans for Thanksgiving and Christmas in the past. So I could really, really relate. But it's just a lovely character study. And I enjoyed it thoroughly. I've watched it three times now. And that's saying a lot because we were in award movie season. Now I'm in catch-up mode. So there you go. There's my top 10. Congratulations to all of them. And we'll see what happens at awards time. Okay, we will dip into the archives in a little bit, and then we'll grab a pencil. But I do want to mention opening in theaters this week, and this is all in the timing for me. This is another one that made my honorable mention, even though I didn't just rattle it off. But American Fiction, which stars Jeffrey Wright in one of his best performances. He is he's a black writer, even though he's not recognized as a black writer, who decides to flip his literary middle finger to the publishing world by writing a book about the black African-American experience of living on the streets and hustling and doing whatever you have to do to survive. And it becomes a hit. And so this is a film that could be a double feature with Spike Lee's Bamboozled. He did this film, directed and co-written by Cord Jefferson, does for the publishing world what Bamboozled did for television. And the fact that Wright creates a piece of fiction about a stereotypical African-American character, and it becomes the biggest hit of his career, even, and he has to live under an alias. That aspect is really fun. There is a lot of family aspect with the people in his life, including Sterling K. Brown. And Leslie Uggams. That part is not as strong for me. It still works, but it's fun watching Jeffrey Wright try to weasel his way in and out of this predicament that he has put himself in. Also, the fact that there are films like, as I mentioned, All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt, and a film that came out this year, 1001, that is the timing on seeing those. If you see American Fiction and see those films, it kind of lampoons that experience. And that's not a slight on the individual films itself, but it's a fun jab. It's a jab that I did enjoy. So anyway, American Fiction opening this weekend at your favorite art house theater. Jeffrey Wright might be thought about at awards time, I hope. But yeah, a really good look at the publishing world. All right. I also catched up on the never-ending pile of movies that have been sent to me. I want to thank Kino Lorber and Film Movement for their patience. This week was the birthday of actress Anna Mae Wong, and I got to see one of her films. And, of course, she got a little more notice last year with her appearance in the fictional film Babylon. But from Kino Lorber is a 1929 silent film called Piccadilly, where Wong plays a kitchen worker who immediately jumps into the limelight as a dance star and becomes the target of every man's fantasy. For a 1929 film, really good fluid camera work and also low-key silent acting. I think we're used to the kind of Gloria Swanson over-the-top giant gestures and giant eye bugging, and that is not the case in this film. Also, the film has been remastered, so it's not just black and white. There are moments of blue and gray and gold and gray. It's a nice transfer and a cool look at the backstage drama, all fronted by Anna Mae Wong. So that is out on Kino Lorber. Also out on Kino Lorber, and this is what I treated myself to for my birthday, but the 1964 John Frankenheimer action film, The Train, starring Burt Lancaster as a member of the French Resistance, I know, whose job is to thwart a Nazi officer played by Paul Scofield, I know, who has decided to take some of the art from other countries that Germany has invaded. It's near the end of World War II. The Germans have all but surrendered. And Schofield's going to try to hijack several train cars filled with very valuable art. It's like the Monuments Men, but it moves more and it's better looking. A really nice stunt work from Lancaster. It's one of his stoic performances, but really good directing from John Frankenheimer. I believe this got a screenplay nomination, and the 4K release, again, cleans up a really what was already a good-looking black-and-white film from 1964 and makes it look really fresh. So I was really happy to watch The Train from Kino Lorber. When my kid came home from school, I had found in my browsing through various stores where you can buy used physical copies of films and music, but a couple of films that were shot in Chicago. I went through a phase where I was trying to show Chicago films to the kids so they have an idea, and I talked them into the 1986 buddy cop film Running Scared, because when I think Chicago police officers, I think Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines. And this was Crystal's first real cinematic break. I mean, he had done Rabbit Test, but that was and this is a couple of years before When Harry Met Sally. And Hines had already done some films like White Nights and Wolfen, but he had not really carried a film yet, but he was teamed up again. Last time was with Mikhail Baryshnikov, this time with Billy Crystal. And they're two cops that are on the trail of a drug dealer played by a very young Jimmy Smits. Joey Pants is in this, Dan Hedaya, there's some familiar faces. The one I always remember about this film is it was cold but not snowy. So if you pay attention, you can see a lot of shaving cream in the background and trees and on the sidewalks. The kid liked it because it was more wisecracking than they had anticipated. This, you have to remember, the buddy cop film really jumped in the 80s with the trilogy, really, well, 48 Hours, and then it really boomed with Lethal Weapon. But there were stuff in between, like this one. That's it's probably the JV of the buddy cop films, but still fun and a lot of Chicago stuff. And I forgot about the ridiculous car chase on train rails. So anyway, we watched Running Scared. The Soci family watched the original and the musical of The Color Purple, and both are equally strong. Even though it didn't make my top 10. The musical didn't make my top 10, but they both can exist in the same universe. Nothing wrong with that. As I mentioned, I showed them The Favorite before Poor Things. We had our holiday tradition of White Christmas and Muppet Christmas Carol. We all wound up liking Wonka more than we anticipated. It helps that the director of Paddington was involved. My kid could get past Timothy Chalamet, and he's fine. I don't have as big an axe to grind with him. It's again one of those films where you don't know it's a musical, and it's done well. I'm okay with this. Of course, I was okay for the most part with Tim Burton's version of The Chocolate Factory because Charlie's a good kid. That's the one thing that, if anything else, that film got right. So anyway, I was dreading Wonka, and I wound up liking it a little more than I thought. I mentioned Piccadilly from Kino Lorber. Also out on Kino Lorber is a remastered version of the 1999 documentary The Life and Times of Allen Ginsberg. Loads of interviews, an excellent look at the man and the poet over the decades. I got to find out more about his family life and lots of fun interviews with his contemporaries. So if you're really into Allen Ginsberg, this is definitely up your alley. Also out on Kino Lorber is a documentary called Your Friend Memphis. And for me, this was a film that could be a double feature for Life Animated. This is the story of a young man with cerebral palsy who is striving for independence. He's 24. He has dreams of being an extra in New York City, but he's trying to find jobs and be on his own. He's an Uber driver in Austin, wants to get back into films and filmmaking. So there's the conflict with that and his divorced parents. And then there's the friendship he has with an up-and-coming singer who's trying to make a splash for themselves on YouTube. They've been friends since they were 14. He was 14. Her name is Seneca. Very pretty opera singer, studying opera, and wants to be in the same city as her college. And it's that uncomfortable feeling. I've been there, and probably you have been as well, where you want the friendship to be more than the friendship. And we get to witness this on camera. And it's really one of the more hard things to watch. And what Seneca's trying to do and move on with her next life chapter, and as well as he. We get a lot of interviews with Memphis's mother, who is bipolar. He thinks he's Forrest, and he thinks that Seneca is Jenny. There's a really – he travels all the way to across the state of Texas to be at her high school graduation, stays over. There's also a really uncomfortable moment where he is he cannot get any aid from the state of Texas and gets into his argument with his dad about who he might be voting for in 2020. And it really and his father tears into him for all the wrong reasons. And then, not to give away everything else, but Memphis winds up moving to L.A., and even that doesn't turn out the way it does. It's a heartbreaking aspect of it's already tough to be in your 20s and trying to find your path, but to be able to have cerebral palsy and still doing it. And he doesn't pull any punches, and he kind of is bare in front of the camera, kind of bones and everything. It's a very brave, heartbreaking film to watch, and it's definitely worth checking out, called Your Friend Memphis from Kino Lorber. So there you go. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, we're going to go into the archives, and then we'll go around the horn and grab a pencil. But because I got to watch White Christmas, the film, with my family, and we got to see it at Beef and Boards, it was fun seeing some friends on stage doing that show, I haven't done this in the last year or so, and I should make this an annual event. But I'm going to replay my 2018 interview with author Steve Taravella, who wrote a biography on actress Mary Wicks. Classic that lady. So we're going to replay my interview with Steve and his book, Mary Wicks, I Know I've Seen That Face Before. Enjoy. Steve, to start with, tell me your first pop culture encounter with Mary Wicks.
Wow, that's a good question. I guess I remember seeing her as Miss Cathcart, the nosy, man-hungry neighbor in the old Dennis the Menace TV series. And I was just delighted with the energy that she brought to that. She was an annoying character by any measure, but there was something really lovable about her, wasn't mm-hmm. there? So that was late 50s and early 60s. That's probably the first time I remember being conscious of her.
Okay. Mine was, I did a stage production of The Man Who Came to Dinner when I was in high school. And what has become practice for me is that, you know, once I get done with a play, I tend to, if there is a film version, I tend to seek it out just to watch. And, of course, she played the nurse in that. And, man, well, first off, I'm like, well, these are grown-ups doing this, not teenagers. But she was just on it. And then from then on, I think especially with a career like hers, you see her pop up in other things, whether it's 20 years old or recent, and she becomes that lady. And then there's, I think, a rite of passage when finally, as a fan, you have her name committed to memory. Was that the case with you?
Well said. I think that's a nice description of the kind of affection she engenders in people. And it's funny that you mentioned The Man Who Came to Dinner, because that was really a career-defining role for her. It was her first big Broadway role. She originated that part in the George S. Kaufman show. Was the only stage performer from the production to be cast in the film, which was her first major film. And then she went on to do other versions of it in television and radio, and sort of felt that that part of Miss Preen was hers, and in fact sometimes resented those occasions when other actresses were cast in the role. What part did you play?
Oh, it was my first high school role. I was one of the convicts invited over for dinner. Yeah, so I...
The show still... It still holds up all these years later, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's fun. You know, well, annoying guests who stay too long, that's universal. There is no fad.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I guess, how did the book come about for you?
Well, I didn't set out to write Mary Wicks' biography, to be sure, but I had, as a journalist, always wanted to write a biography, and I found myself some years ago in a position where I could take about a year out of the workforce and work on a book. And I, some years before that, had always wanted to interview Mary, assuming I would write a magazine profile of her, because really she worked with everybody who was anybody, and I felt certain she'd have interesting stories to tell. So I started with her. I thought, well, let me look into it and see if her life was interesting enough to justify a book. You know, a book-length treatment, because really it might not have been. And I quickly decided it was. She had a fascinating life. The original Mary Poppins, which many people didn't know, mm-hmm. the animator's model for Cruella de Vil in, you know, in Disney's 101 Dalmatians. The work she did with Orson Welles in the 1930s in the groundbreaking Mercury Theater Company production. Those were all really... you know, and those three examples, TV, radio, and film right there. Mary worked across the spectrum. And then when I realized that she was also Lucille Ball's closest friend for 30 years and part of that circle of, you know, mid-last century comic performers, it just opened up other doors. And I decided, yeah, there really is enough here for a book, and approached the people who were managing her estate, who were a little apprehensive at first because Mary was quite a private person, but in the end gave me the support I needed to go ahead.
I would say it seemed like the biggest challenge besides as you mentioned, but I mean, finding peers of hers that were still around, still alive.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I approached that rather methodically. I interviewed in the end almost 300 people, but plotted them out by age and started trying to reach those who were in their later years, essentially in hopes of catching them. And I miss some. I mean, I did find quite a lot of people in their 80s and 90s who worked with Mary when she was young or who knew her as a girl in St. Louis, including the girl who played marbles and dolls with Mary on the streets of St. Louis as a 5- and 6-year-old. But I also missed a lot of people and missed them sometimes by almost comical measure. I mean, I remember phoning one woman in St. Louis who I was very eager to speak to. But the woman who picked up the phone said, "Oh, I'll have to call you back. I'm running out to her funeral right now." It was that kind of thing where, you know, by days or weeks, I missed some. It was sort of playing detective, you know, to catch people while they're able to share stories, because you really want those stories of someone's youth.
Mm-hmm. And what was her youth like?
I'd say she was raised in a rather repressive, well, maybe that's unfair to say right off the bat. I'd say she was raised in an almost Victorian conservative community in St. Louis, in a very traditional household. She was raised Episcopalian and raised to believe that church and faith and family were everything, and those are tenets that she carried with her whole life and that shaped a lot of her outlook on things. Church was always a very important part of her life. Even as an adult, she was a very active member of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Beverly Hills. She volunteered at hospitals. But I would say that that in some ways it was a repressive upbringing as well, and that shaped her too. Yet she remained very fond of St. Louis, and your listeners in Indiana might appreciate, of the whole Midwest in general. Mm-hmm. And in her later years, she even considered leaving Southern California and retiring back to St. Louis, where she grew up.
Does the city? I mean, is there a following with her in the city today? I mean, is there a street named after her? Is there still a legacy about her with the city?
Boy, that's a good question. In some circles, I would say yes. I mean, we have to remember that Mary now has been dead for what? Well, she passed in 1995, so it's been quite a while.
Yeah.
There's not a street named after her. Boy, that would be nice. But your question reminds me that there is a star on the St. Louis Walk of Fame in Universal City. In Universal City, just outside of St. Louis proper.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there along with other famous St. Louisans, Betty Grable, Agnes Moorhead, Vincent Price, who was a very close friend of hers from her youth. Well, I think the last thing I would say to that question is, because she performed so many times at the very large, popular outdoor theater there, the Muni, officially the St. Louis Municipal Opera, she does have a following there among people who followed the performing arts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And what got her the bug to become an actor?
Well, I think Mary, who was decidedly unattractive from young, looked for ways to stand out and endear herself to people when maybe expectations of what a woman should look like or how a woman should behave were rather rigid, and she found it hard to succeed in that kind of setting. But when Mary was on stage, which she began essentially in Job's Daughters as a young girl, she always got a great reaction from the audience, and I think, like a lot of performers, thrived on that laughter and that feedback from people. It really gave her a boost of energy and confidence, and in the end, she decided to make that her career. That wasn't what she set out to do, I should say. She set out to study law. I mean, Mary was incredibly smart and clever and followed current events and enjoyed intellectual pursuits, but in the end, she didn't study law, and she didn't pursue a career in law. And some theatrical productions at the Little Theater in St. Louis persuaded her that, yeah, she could make a career of this, or try to. Mm-hmm. I suspect that her success at it surprised her as much as anybody early on.
And I know she wound up doing a lot of repertory theater on the East Coast, which was, you know, at that part of the 20th century, turns out to be great training for an artist.
You're absolutely right. It's hard for people today to appreciate how important those summer theater was or excuse me, those summer theaters were during those years. But places like the now called the Berkshire Theater Festival, but then the Berkshire Playhouse and other theaters in Cape Cod and in the Northeast during summers when people wanted to get where it was cooler and where air conditioning, because they were living where air conditioning wasn't so common, theaters were a big part of people's social life. And Mary did exceptionally well. She did well on stage in the sense that many, many reviews from local papers that I looked at, if they cited one particular performer, it was often Mary they singled out as being exceptional in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And she did well offstage. She really made some lifelong friendships in those theater troupes, people who, you know, she carried with her for the rest of her life.
And also the fact that they were almost at times banging out a play a week.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
To be, and you're rehearsing one show in the morning and maybe another show in the afternoon, and then you're doing a performance that night. And, you know, that's something you got to, you hope you're able to pass on, or at least let younger artists know that's how, at one time, that's how it's done. And in some cases, it still is.
In some cases, it is. You're right. There are a few theaters that still try that. I think it must be exhausting for the performers. But one thing about Mary to keep in mind is, boy, she loved hard work. I mean, she had this work ethic that was just incredible. It's almost as if it wasn't hard and tough and difficult, it wasn't worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary rose to every challenge. She wasn't ever somebody who looked for the easy way out.
And
I think she really enjoyed those theatrical experiences early in her career.
When did she make the trip down to Broadway?
1939 was her first big Broadway show, and that was The Man Who Came to Dinner. So Mary was 29 when she first appeared as Miss Preen. And she at first was staying in boarding houses in Manhattan for young single women. And then as that as the run of that show progressed, she had saved enough where she was able to get her first small apartment to herself in Greenwich Village, and stayed in New York until the mid-1950s before the lure of television and a perhaps more constant paycheck brought her to Southern California, where she lived the rest of her life.
And it was it the trip to California that she solidified the kind of Bat Lady status?
Bat Lady? What do you mean, Bat Lady?
The character that you recognize. You don't know her name, but you recognize her face. Oh, it's her. It's that lady. This, you know.
Oh, that lady. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I would say you're right, because the parts that she got when she first arrived in California were not big starring parts of, so they were the secondary roles that people might remember her from. So she was, for instance, in Short Order, the nurse with Betty Davis in Now Voyager. And many people today still remember that part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wonderful comic relief, comic timing in a melodrama that was otherwise, of course, Betty Davis's picture.
Yeah.
And from there, she went on to many other memorable parts, a lot of the Doris Day pictures at Warner Brothers, some with Danny Thomas, and she really enjoyed those. And of course, then White Christmas, which many people know her most from now today.
Right. Actually, we'll get to that. But yeah, she even did an Abbott and Costello film, which I forgot about.
Yeah, she did. Are you an Abbott and Costello fan?
There used to be I grew up in Flint, Michigan, and there was a channel. It was a TV station in Detroit, and every Sunday morning they'd show an Abbott and Costello movie. So I've probably seen all of them several times.
Oh, how funny!
Yeah.
Well, I had not seen an Abbott and Costello picture in years before I began researching this, and I'd kind of forgotten how talented they really. I mean, I guess I didn't fully appreciate what a great performing duo those fellows were. And Mary with them was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved that. Whodunit was the movie.
Right. So you mentioned White Christmas. So, I mean, at the very Mary Wicks is a part of everybody's, for many people, part of their Christmas tradition when watching that movie every year. So there, and that's, a lot of people can't say that as far as their legacy.
You're right. And for that, I think she was always grateful because, A, Christmas as a holiday was very special to her, partly because of her faith and partly because of what family meant to her. And B, Mary often felt that she was overlooked in the industry. And White Christmas was, if nothing else, a reminder once a year that she was part of Hollywood during an important time of output there. And she also just liked the film and the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. It comes up every year and people ask about her. I've spoken several times at the American Film Institute at Christmas when they screen that in introducing the film. And I love the reaction the film gets now, what, 60 or something years after it was originally screened?
Exactly.
It still has a place in American pop culture. And Mary would be thrilled to see that she's still part of that.
There is a moment I have, and this I always think of this for all character actors everywhere. Although my wife has an MFA, and she says all actors are character actors, but that's, you know, she's the smart one. But when she plants one on Bing Crosby, I have this image of character actors everywhere just standing up and cheering because the that guy or the that girl got the smooch a star, and it's one of my favorite moments in film.
Yeah, that's nice to hear you say. I think she might say something similar. And I share an anecdote in the book about how the scene immediately following that, where he comes in quickly for a second kiss very playfully,
yep,
and catches her off guard, was something that was simply ad-libbed on the set. But the director, Michael Curtiz, decided it worked well enough to keep it in.
Yeah, because it was, it was sincere. It's funny. But and the fact that Bing Crosby didn't repel, that means a lot for certain insecure artists that we all have inside of us.
Well said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say, how did she get the friendship going with Lucille Ball?
Well, I think they were women who had, in the first place, simply a lot in common. They were the same age. They were only 1 year apart. They both had an innate comic sense about life. They looked at things through an unconventional lens. They both liked to perform in front of people. They could both be rather severe and harsh at times. I mean, Mary, for all the wonderful things about her, didn't have a lot of warm, fuzzy edges to her, and neither did Lucille Ball. They met in the late 1940s on a television show when they were both guest starring in the same segment. And just formed a natural friendship. They lived rather close to each other. And Mary was as much a part of the Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz family as anybody for a very long time. I would say probably less so when Lucille Ball married Gary Morton. But for 30 to 35 years, they really were extremely close. I mean, Desi Arnaz describes Mary as absolutely her mother's closest friend. And she was at the home all the time. She was there for holidays. She traveled with Lucy. She bopped in and out of the house as if it was her second home. And they had a genuine affection for each other and just really enjoyed each other's company. In fact, it was Lucy Arnaz who gave the eulogy at Mary's funeral.
And it was the first time she appeared on Lucy's show. She was the dance instructor?
You're right.
Okay.
Yes. Mary appeared. She was one of Lucille Ball's favorite guest stars and appeared in 22 or 23 different episodes of various Lucy projects. But the first one was, in fact, the episode of I Love Lucy called The Ballet, where she was the severe, no-nonsense ballet instructor. Abba, Abba,
yes.
Abba.
I say, was that whole site? I mean, how? Let me try again. That whole dance class. I'm assuming that. How much of it was scripted and how much of it was improvised on the spot, or at least in rehearsal?
I'm really glad you asked that because people often assume that so many things in I Love Lucy, because of how hilarious and spontaneous they seemed, were ad-libbed. But it's important for the reputations of those writers who worked so hard to point out that no, absolutely not. Very little was ad-libbed. And in that segment, nothing was ad-libbed. Everything was rehearsed and scripted and written down. And they performed it exactly as the final script was. So when Lucy gets her leg caught in the bar, mm-hmm. for your listeners who might remember that, that was scripted. That wasn't Lucy during filming slipping or anything. And every part of it was written out. And the spontaneity that came across on screen just really speaks to the talent of the two women.
You mentioned the fact that she was on several episodes of the series. I mean, in all the incarnations of the series. It reminds me of, I don't know if you ever watched Columbo when you were younger.
Oh, yeah.
So it cracked me up when, you know, you'd have somebody like Jack Cassidy or Robert Culp return as a different character. I'm like, no, that's a bad court system. Why are you letting him out? So you're like, wait, why is the dance instructor now working as a clerk? What, she lost her job? Because she's that recognizable. She's that lady. So yeah.
I love how you look at that. And I have to tell you, I'm a big fan of Columbo. But it kills me to turn on a Columbo rerun and see Jack Cassidy again.
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right. But I'm also glad you mentioned that because of the many, many television performances that Mary gave. Honestly, one of my very favorites is an episode she did of Columbo. She played a nosy landlady who basically distracts Columbo with inane, meandering conversation when he's trying to get clear, quick answers from her as to her observations of some murder. And she does it so well, and she's so amused. And you believe that woman, that character. And it was a rather long scene.
Well, sure.
And I just loved it, absolutely loved it.
Which
so
is
for anybody who might not remember the woman we're talking about, because we're doing radio and TV and you're not able to show clips, you can find that episode online. I believe it was called, I want to say The Last Frame, as in picture frame, something like that. But if they Google Mary Wicks and Columbo, it'll come up and you'll see
there
it. Just a wonderful performance she gave.
And now that you mentioned that, I want that character and Columbo to be in a production of Love Letters. It'd be 3 hours, but it would be fun. So.
You're right.
So, I mean, and I know Mary was constantly working. The thing about being a supporting actor or that person was, you know, you went to where the work was. You didn't, you know, whether it was the stage or TV or movies. And, you know, in the middle part of the century, if you were a movie star doing television, that meant your career was over. Now, things have changed, obviously, in the last couple decades or so. But, you know, she had that thing of being able to bounce from one thing to another. But as I read in your book, she also wrote letters to producers, right, to just remind them that she's still around?
Yeah, which in some ways is very sad that somebody of her stature who did so much felt the need and, in fact, perceived an actual need. It wasn't a misperception that she had to constantly remind casting directors who she was and that she was there. But part of that, I think, comes from, well, as I say, genuine need to work and keep her face in front of producers and casting folks. But part of it was surely that she was, for her entire life, a single woman who supported herself, a working woman. She never made enormous salaries, not some of the salaries that maybe today's popular actresses would get, and wasn't a top tier. And maybe in some years was paid less than a man would be paid for the same thing. So she really, she needed to work. A lot of it was financial. And because her family had suffered so much in St. Louis during the Depression years, she was also terribly insecure about money and finances, much more so than even actors who were regularly insecure, where's the next job coming from, kind of a thing. No, Mary was always frightened of not having enough money to live on.
Shifting gears a little bit, I didn't know this until I read the book, and I was so excited to hear that that lady, that a supporting character, got to play, I think, one of the more challenging roles in American theater. But she was in a production of The Glass Menagerie. How did that come about?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? How many people would think she could be effective at that? And yet those who saw it say she absolutely was. It came about because of the affection that I described earlier that Mary had for St. Louis in general and her alma mater, Washington University. She kept in touch with many people at the school. On occasion, she contributed funds to help the theater focus of the school grow, and worked with the head of the drama department there to find something that would bring her back as a performer in residence or teacher in residence. She actually did teach a couple of classes there in the theater arts. And they came up with that one. And it is surprising because not many people would perceive Mary as maybe skilled at conveying the kind of pathos and neuroses and extreme seriousness that that character needs to convey. But she did. And maybe it was the St. Louis nature of it that spoke to her, that, you know, the play happens to be set in St. Louis, mm-hmm. or the affection she had for the playwright, Tennessee Williams. I don't know. But I know she wanted to do it. She pushed for that. Surely, I think part of it is she wanted to show casting directors outside of St. Louis that she could do more than maybe the meandering landlady on Columbo, you know?
Right, of that course.
Yeah, and she did. She did have some other interesting dramatic parts.
Is there any footage of that performance anywhere?
No, there's not. Not that I have found. The university doesn't have any, and I wasn't able to identify anybody who happened to take sort of home movies of it. So no,
right. Worth a shot.
Yeah.
And I know, of course, we're going in some form of chronological order, but I know it was cool to see her get a resurgence in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, because how many people get to have a, as you say, a resurgence late in life?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Mary was born in 1910, so, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when the Sister Act pictures came up, for instance, you know, she was approaching 80.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's exactly what did happen, a resurgence. And I would push it back even a little before Sister Act, the picture that she did directed by Mike Nichols, Postcards from the Edge.
Yep.
Probably set her on a higher profile path for the last number of years of her life. She loved doing that picture. It introduced her to new, younger audiences. Put her opposite some wonderful performers like Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine and Annette Bening. And she had a great experience with that. But then, yes, the Sister Act pictures, which, to be honest, when I describe Mary to young people who might not know her from some of the things you've asked me about, I mentioned that because many of them remember more vividly the Whoopi Goldberg films,
right.
Sister Act. And yeah.
Well, that, and she has two nun franchises on her resume.
That's a great way to say it.
It's true.
You're right. She did the Sister Act pictures and absolutely the Trouble with Angels pictures. And that's now what I'm going to start calling those, the two nun franchises. Yes.
Well, and wasn't it in the Troubles series that I think there were a couple things that she had to do? And I thought the story is, of course, you always tell a director, when told, can you do something? You always say yes, even if it's not true.
Right.
And I think, wasn't one of them swimming and the other was driving a bus?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think the driving a bus was a problem, although you're right, she didn't know how to do it.
Okay.
But they could pretty much work around that. But the bigger problem was the swimming pool, because there was a scene where she was called upon to jump into the water in full nun habit and quote unquote rescue two difficult teenage girls at this Catholic school who'd been horsing around in the water. And Mary, who honestly told the producer and director, Bill Fry, in advance that she didn't know how to swim.
Oh, okay.
Had also told them that she was taking lessons all during the production so she'd be ready for that scene. And the studio, Columbia, paid for her to take lessons at the YWCA so that she would be up for that. And then comes the day of shooting, and Mary just couldn't go in the water.
Oh.
And she offered up, I should say, all these excuses, to the producer as to why she couldn't go in. She was afraid. She didn't want to tell them she hadn't taken the lessons. At heart, Mary was really a very honest, ethical person, and it must have killed her to lie about this. Mm-hmm. But she did, in fact, lie, not because she didn't want to take the lessons, but because she feared going into the water would reveal to everybody on the set that she wore a special elastic band on one of her arms to control lymph drainage from having had breast removed. Mm-hmm. And this was late 1960s, and women with breast cancer were not as open about it as they are today. She was terribly afraid of losing work, being branded as unhealthy and damaged goods, and somebody who wouldn't be reliable on a set because of health needs. So she went through hoops in that production and others to keep from everybody involved the news of her breast cancer and the operation. So the producer had to very hastily find a stuntman who was Mary's size, who could quickly don that outfit and get in water and do that scene. So when viewers now see the nun from behind going into the water, that's not Mary. Mm-hmm. And when Mary is shown from the front in the water, there are two two members of the film crew on either side of her underwater holding her up for that, and then quickly walking her out as soon as the director got the shot.
But just for the record, gang, that guy cannot kiss Bing Crosby. So that's, and he can't do the Glass Menagerie. So take that.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, I know near the end of her career, near the end of her life, she had a nice 1-2 punch with Little Women and then to be the voice in a Disney film in Hunchback of Notre Dame. How did those come about?
Well, Little Women was a story that Mary had loved since she was a little girl, quite honestly. So I think she must have just absolutely loved being offered that film. It's not anything that she pursued or went for or made happen. It was just a role that was offered to her. Ironically, it was offered to her after it was offered to Katharine Hepburn, who was in the original 1930s version. Certainly the only time in Mary's career she received a role, because Katharine Hepburn turned it down. That was a difficult film for her because it required a lot of location work in Canada during the winter. Mm. Mary was rather frail at that time. Her sight had deteriorated quite badly. She had trouble getting around. She was sort of isolated on the set, which it was mostly a younger crew. She didn't know people. I would say that was not a terribly pleasant experience for her, even though she enjoyed the story. Whereas Hunchback of Notre Dame was really wonderful for her because it enabled her to show that voice work was something she could do. Mm-hmm. And that meant she wouldn't have to go to stage sets and navigate cables on the floor with her poor eyesight and confront stairs and stages and things. So voice work at the end became more important to her. And unfortunately, while the taping experience was really nice for her and she was paid well for it and enjoyed it, the filmmakers needed to have some of her lines redone very routinely after everything was in the can, so to speak. But Mary had just passed away.
Right.
So they turned to a few other people who they thought might be able to mimic Mary's voice rather than re-dub the entire role of the film. And the actress Jane Withers did it, and I think people now who watch the film really would have immense trouble discerning Mary's voice from Jane Withers as Mary in those few scenes. There were about three scenes where Jane did that.
Right. And what those films have in common, kind of what we were talking earlier with White Christmas, is, every generation has their Little Women. I know PBS is putting out a new version of Little Women this year. It seems like every decade there is, a BBC masterpiece, PBS, what have you, of classic literature. And for everybody, she's going to be a part of their, you know, for a lot of people, that is their Little Women. So she's a part of that. And of course, you know, her voice is on a disc somewhere in millions of homes for kids. And that's not a bad legacy to have.
Yeah, you're right. That's a nice way to look at it. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just curious. When was the last time you were channel surfing and you came across her on the TV?
Oh, that's a good question. And I can answer that really quickly. Now Voyager was shown very recently on the Turner Classic Movies, I think. And I did stop and watched even more than the scenes that Mary's in, because I think it's just a wonderful picture. Have you seen Now Voyager?
It's been a long time. And now that you've brought it up, I'm going to have to go down to the basement and grab it. I tend to have stuff on disc as opposed to DVR or streaming. So, I'll be watching that again. I think the last thing I saw was White Christmas because it was December. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a personal favorite of her work that is your go-to?
Well, I think people, smile when I say that of all of her TV work, I really do like that Columbo episode. It just captures so much of her in one scene. And there's also one episode of Here's Lucy series where Mary plays a nurse,
yep,
to Lucille Ball in the hospital that just cracks me up every time. And but also I do like some of Mary's serious roles. She played a scientist in an episode of Kolchak, sort of a supernatural TV mystery in the mid-70s that was really good.
Darren McGavin.
But film-wise... Exactly. Okay, so you know that.
Yeah,
Night
Stalker. Yeah, of course. I think that's.
Yes, that's
Night Stalker. I think that's on MeTV right now, on a regular basis. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You continue. I think we've talked a lot about, and people know her maybe for her her comedic work. What are some of the more dramatic, or because I mean she practically did every genre if I remember right.
Yeah, she did. I mean, she even did musicals on Broadway. And she just loved performing. And even the radio pieces brought her a lot of pleasure. And she took them very seriously. And, she worked in every medium. Most of her work was comic, but not, I wouldn't say, for those who don't know her, I wouldn't say slapstick or farce. No, she just brought sort of a comic energy or a comic element to a serious film. There was something. Oh, have you seen How to Murder Your Wife with Jack Lemmon?
Long, long time ago.
Yeah. Well, it's the only movie in which Mary gets drunk, and she plays drunk so well. And maybe because it's so so atypical for her, that the unexpected nature of it makes it even more entertaining. But I really thought she did a spectacular job in that. And some of the nasty parts that she played, just a really bitter landlady in something called Fate is the Hunter, a movie with Suzanne Pleshette and Glenn Ford about an investigation into a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And that sticks in my mind, too. On the sweet side, there were, the Doris Day movies on Moonlight Bay and By the Light of the Silvery Moon. Those are really memorable.
I also remember. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to offer just one more because you're
Please.
Asking for serious ones,
sure.
I realize. There was something in the early 1980s called Touched by Love with Deborah Raffin, where Mary played a teacher's aide. It was one of two movies that she did with Deborah Raffin for Raffin's production company. Mm-hmm. And both of them offered Mary serious roles. And I just thought they were really nice and well done.
You mentioned she had a character that only played drunk once, and she was very particular about certain behavioral traits for her characters, right?
Yeah, you're right. There were things she didn't want her characters to do because she found them personally, morally objectionable, which meant there were roles that she didn't get. There were certain lines of dialogue she refused to say, which meant, again, there were roles she didn't get. So she could have made more money and worked even more often than she did had she not had such a strict lens through which she saw what was acceptable and what wasn't. And sometimes, you know, she really shot herself in the foot with that approach toward work because she lost some great jobs. She was offered, not just offered, but producers really wanted her for a secondary role in Mrs. Doubtfire, the Robin Williams picture
right.
with Sally Field.
Yeah.
And apparently the final version has a lot cut out, and some of the things that were cut out were the parts that Mary had objected to. And I think in the end, she regretted not having taken that because it turned out to be a very sweet picture with nothing objectionable in it. But the original script for the character that they wanted her for had things that she didn't want to say.
Hmm.
And even earlier than that, in the mid-1970s, she was part of a TV ensemble with Barnard Hughes called Doc.
Yep.
And it was doing very well. And Mary was a little bit full of herself with how popular this show was and demanded script approval and said she wanted not just approval over her character's lines, but lines other characters would say, so that if she found something in the script that Barnard Hughes' character, the lead, was to say that she didn't like, that she could have it removed. And the producers got so fed up with that, they fired her. It's one of the few times in her career she was fired, and but not the only time that she suffered for those sort of moral proclamations she had.
And it's funny you mentioned that because another performance of hers that comes to mind was her episode, her one episode of MASH, where she was a brash talking, heavy drinking lady.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. That was a rather odd episode. It's funny, so many people remember that, and yet I think by today's standards, we cringe at it.
Yeah, we do.
You know?
It's yeah, there's a rape joke that is said, it's not today.
Exactly. No, I mean, the idea that it's funny that a woman falsely claims rape,
yep.
You know, just feeding into these notions that women who claim such things are making it up. I don't think that would be made today.
No.
But in 1973 or four,
right.
That was a popular episode.
Yep. Well, I have to mention to folks the reason how we got connected. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, you can use social media for good, not for evil. there's a group of guys that I watch movies with every week when I'm able to, and we were it was before the holidays. We were watching The Music Man, which she has a role as one of the cheapy ladies, one of the chicky ladies.
Exactly.
And I wrote on social media that The Music Man reminded me that I wanted to date Shirley Jones, but I wanted to go drinking with Mary Wicks. And and that, well, after reading the biography, that's not happening. That wouldn't have happened. So but I think because she had so many stories, and I think the MASH thing probably was also in my head, that you know, she had 1,000 stories to tell, and it would just be fun to, you know, huddle up in a corner and hear all of them. But apparently you'd be over ginger ale. But I'll take it anyway. And
I'm glad to hear that.
And that's how you responded. So, ladies and gentlemen, it can be done use for good. So,
right. Well, I'm glad you reached out that way, and this has been really fun talking to you and to your listeners in Indiana. And please let them know if they'd like more, they can find the book on Amazon in four formats: hardback, paperback, Kindle, and audiobook.
And while I got you here, what else have you written?
Oh, I am a one-book author. This took so many years and so much time, I don't think I'll invest time in another one.
Wow, okay.
I did this as a labor of love. I make my living working in international development, so this was something completely done for the passion of it. And I don't think I'll do another one. But thanks for asking about that.
Doing what I can to help spread the good word. So, Steve, thank you so much for your time.
No, really appreciate it. Thank you.
From 2018, my chat with author Steve Taravella and the book Mary Wicks, I know I've seen that face before. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, before we go around the horn, I want to give a shout-out to the Golan Globus Theater guys. I didn't get a chance to mention because we didn't have a show last week. Last week they did John Borman's Zardoz, and for the month of January, Misunderstood Geniuses, and they are doing this week Death Rider in the House of Vampires, directed by Glenn Danzig. So there you go. That's happening over at Golan Globus Theater. All right, just going quickly around the horn, over at the Artcraft Theater in Franklin, July 5th and 6th, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m., from 1961, Blue Hawaii. So I get to tell the story of, yes, Elvis Presley plays the son of a pineapple kingpin in Hawaii. He gets out of the military, and his parents want him to take over the family business, but he just wants to lay on the beach and play guitar and sing with his girlfriend. And yeah, Joan Blackman's in this film, and Angela Lansbury plays Elvis's mother. She was probably 9 when she had Elvis, along with her other cinematic son, Lawrence Tierney, in The Manchurian Candidate. And I love the story that I was watching this film. My wife is working on her laptop. Anytime I can get Lynn to look up from her laptop with the movie, that's saying something. And she did. In Angela Lansbury's first scene, she's kind of a Southern Belle, Big Mama type character who comes in, talks to her son, talks to her husband, and just kind of kvetches and storms out. And my wife looks up, then looks back down at her computer and just says, even she can't make this crap sound good. That aside, it is one of Elvis's better lightweight musicals, so it's not as good as Viva Las Vegas, but it's a fun one, and you don't need to see Paradise Hawaiian style. So anyway, that's this weekend at the Historic Artcraft Theater, January 12th and 13th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. Fargo is showing over there, January 19th and 20th, To Kill a Mockingbird. And of course, there is a tour coming with Richard Thomas playing Atticus. That is going to be over at Clues Memorial Hall. So make a note of that. And then January 26th and 27th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. All right. I have said before in my years that watching Inherit the Wind, the original film with Frederick March and Spencer Tracy, I've always said that is the acting equivalent of a heavyweight boxing match. What's on the undercard is Shatner versus Montalban in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So that is all happening at the Historic Artcraft Theater. Actually, before we go around the horn, I do want to raise a glass to Tom Wilkinson. What a career. A guy who, again, English actor who started out on the stage. It was stage, screen, television. Did not matter. Constantly working. And going back, the first thing I really noticed him in was The Full Monty, as was a lot of people. But I forgot that he was in Sakharov from HBO in 1984. And he was on Prime Suspect with Helen Mirren. He was in The Name of the Father, as well as Priest, Mr. Dashwood in Sense and Sensibility, The Ghost in the Darkness, which, and Smilla's Sense of Snow. Laura Jansen and I had fun watching The Ghost in the Darkness. But he was the older guy, of course, in The Full Monty, and that just led him off on a path of that guy work. Wild, Oscar and Lucinda, The Governess, Rush Hour. Of course, he had a nice wicked turn in Shakespeare in Love, Ride with the Devil, The Patriot. First Academy Award nomination, and this is where you got to commit his name to memory, In the Bedroom, which is a gut punch of a movie and needs to be watched again. The Importance of Being Earnest had a nice light touch on that. The HBO film Normal with him and Jessica Lange. A Girl with a Pearl Earring had the fun thing as the doctor in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Stage Beauty. Carmine Falcone in Batman Begins. Yep, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. That's a horse crap of a film, but he's really good in it. Separate Lies. The Last Kiss, Cassandra's Dream, his second nomination for Michael Clayton. He's really good in that. That's another one I need to revisit. John Adams, who played Benjamin Franklin in the HBO miniseries. Rock and Roll of Valkyrie, Duplicity. The Debt, The Conspirator. Yeah, even good as James Reed and The Green Hornet. The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Oh, yeah, he was in The Lone Ranger. Oof. Belle, Grand Budapest Hotel, Good People, Jenny's Wedding, The Choice, Snowden. Gosh. Yeah, constantly working. The Titan, the 2018 miniseries of Watership Down. His last credit was the miniseries of The Full Monty from last year. So salute to Tom Wilkinson. Thank you, sir. All right, friends. We start on Facebook from last week, so sorry about this. Again, if I read yours twice, I apologize to the listener, because there's just a lot of you folks out there, and that's all right. We start with Abdul, who just writes Aquaman 2. Thanks, you buddy. Daniel writes The Big Sleep, The World of Henry Orient, Oh God, Candy Cane Lane. Eric writes, I've been trying to reach 5,000 first watches logged in on Letterboxd by the end of the year. As of right now, I've got two films to go before Monday, piece of cake. Thank you, Eric. Congratulations. His first views, Clockers. Wow. Hell's Heroes, Blood and Sand, and The Quiet Girl. His rewatches, Curse of the Cat People, Holiday Affair, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer from 1964, not a film, but a TV show. Sorry, a TV special. Goldfinger and Oppenheimer, which he deemed his Christmas gift. Kurt writes, at Beltrace, I showed Last Christmas on Christmas, because this is my last Christmas as chaplain before I retire. We watched Miracle on 34th Street on Saturday before Christmas. I went to see Napoleon in the cinema. Kurt, congratulations on your retirement. I hope to actually meet you in person someday. We'll get down to Bloomington sometime. I got to know Kurt from Drinks with Dee Dee, which I'm hoping to get back onto that show sometime. We will see. So anyway, congrats, Kurt. I loved hearing the films that you would share with the gang over at Beltrace. Patty writes Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, and Stardust. Eric writes The Big Lebowski, first time for Julie, just prior to putting down our new living room rug. It really brings the room together. And Eric, don't pee on it. Doug writes a couple from a century ago, Harold Lloyd's Why Worry, and our gang's Dogs of War. Dick Van Dyke in Fitzwillie, Hitchcock's first, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and two from this year, Anatomy of a Fall and Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 3. Monica writes Philadelphia Story, It's a Wonderful Life, and Home Alone. JJ writes, first watches, Maestro, A-plus cinematography, The Iron Claw, the feel-bad movie of the year. Yeah, and it could have been even more badder. I know what I said. And Ferrari, disappointed. I'll have to give it another try at home with captions on. Wow. His oldies were Rookie of the Year and The Hunt for Red October, and for Christmas in Connecticut, and A Christmas Story. David writes A Christmas Carol, the Sim version, It's Christmas Carol, Polar Express, Godzilla King of the Monsters, Leave the World Behind, Beverly Hills Cop, Backdraft, and Men in Black. Robert Muggy writes Lawrence of Arabia, Oppenheimer, Basquiat, I Was Born, But, Good Morning, What Did the Lady Forget, Maestro, and Little Richard, I Am Everything. Jamie writes, oh my, Olaf's Frozen Adventure, Frozen Fever, Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the live-action one. That's a film. The original? That's a TV special. Genie, Pinocchio's Christmas, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, A Very Muppet Christmas, Pinocchio's Christmas, Meet Me in St. Louis, Polar Express, Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas, Home Alone and Home Alone 2, Rudolph's Shiny New Year, a special, Santa Claus the Movie, The Grinch, A Smoky Mountain Christmas, Twas the Night Before Christmas, The Year Without a Santa Claus, Twas the Night Before Christmas, Muppet Christmas Carol, Die Hard, and How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Okay, that's a lot of Grinch there. Thank you. David writes Barbie, Weird, the Al Yankovic story, The Creator, It's a Wonderful Life, The Year Without a Santa Claus, and Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Craig writes the battleship Potemkin, The Navigator, The Kid, The Cure, The Gold Rush, and Easy Street, so Chaplin run there, and The Omen and Damien Omen 2. Lou Harry writes Boulevard, A Hollywood Story, about Gloria Swanson's efforts to make Sunset Boulevard musical long before Andrew Lloyd Webber. That's right. Origin, The Marvels, Eileen, Godzilla Minus One, Anybody But You, also known as Much Ado About Sydney Sweeney's Cleavage. Thank you, Lou. Gary writes Wildcard, Mirror, Blitz, Tokyo Godfathers, and Casablanca. Brian writes Legend of the Rollerblade 7, Three from Hell, Tropic Thunder, and Ken Russell's ABC of British Music. And I believe Ken Russell's films are on the Criterion Channel because I love his bonkery mind. He's bonkers. Love his work. Amanda went to the library, The Flamingo Kid, The Bat, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, While You Were Sleeping, The Nutcracker, Christmas Carol with Patrick Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life, The Original Miracle on 34th Street, Christmas Story, Love Actually, Die Hard, Happiest Season, A Merry Ingles Christmas, Missing the Lucy Blackman Case, May, December, Naiad, Feast of the Seven Fishes, The Foreigner, I need to revisit that one. I really like that, with Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan, and Maestro. And Julia writes Saltburn. Okay, we now go to this week's Facebook post, because that's what happens, and we start this week's post thread with Judy, who writes, over the holidays, Maestro and Naiad. The latter was the much better film, in my humble opinion. Thank you, Judy. David writes, all the Bourne movies minus Legacy, all the Indiana Jones movies minus Crystal Skull, The Exorcist, Believer, and Eraserhead. Dustin writes, Miracle on 34th Street, White Christmas, The Pink Panther, Shot in the Dark, Return of the Pink Panther, Pink Panther Strikes Again, Revenge of the Pink Panther, Trial of the Pink Panther, Curse of the Pink Panther, Son of the Pink Panther, Lost in Translation, Maestro, The Color Purple, the musical, and The Iron Claw. Thank you, Dustin. Amanda went to the library, Holiday Affair, the remake of The Taking of the Pelham 1-2-3, all three Lord of the Rings, Harry and Tonto, and New Year's Eve. Eric writes Saltburn. Dakota writes Raiders of the Lost Ark. Jessica writes, I finally saw Barbie. I think my expectations were too high because I was underwhelmed and I really wanted to like it. Well, I'm sorry about that, stage dear. That happens sometimes. Ryan writes The Holdovers and the musical of The Color Purple. Lou Harry writes Start Cheering with cameos from The Three Stooges, Quiz Lady, and half of the Spirited Away live capture. Jamie writes The Incredibles, Hercules, Tarzan, both Disney's, and Monsters, Inc. David writes Once Upon a Time in the West, The Kingdom of Heaven, and Howl's Moving Castle. Kurt writes An American in Paris at Belle Trace, The Iron Claw, The Boys in the Boat, and Anyone But You in the cinema. Ah, so Eric has reposted, so you're going to hear a repeat, but it's okay. 2 weeks worth. First Views, Clockers, Hell's Heroes, Blood and Sand, The Quiet Girl, The Holdovers, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, really, and Killers of the Flower Moon. His rewatches, Curse of the Cat People, Holiday Affair, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Goldfinger on Christmas Eve because it's fun and we like it, Oppenheimer, A Christmas Gift, Absence of Malice, Barbie and Cousins, both Christmas gifts to Jenny, and The Searchers. All right. Doug writes a couple of Marx Brothers, Horse Feathers and Duck Soup, a couple Pythons, Holy Grail and Life of Brian, a couple more from 2023, American Symphony and Saltburn. Plus, It Happened One Night, Women Haters, early Three Stooges, Bringing Up Baby, Anastasia, and the documentary Friedkin Uncut. Daniel writes the 1974 Three Musketeers, Dix, the musical, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and the Chamber of Secrets, as well as the 2015 Cinderella. Frank writes Anon, quite good, Midsommar, beautiful but quite disturbing, and The Boy and the Heron, wonderful. Matt writes, I recently resubscribed to the Criterion Channel for the year and have been watching a bunch of things on there. Cool. Jackie Chan's Police Story and Police Story 2. Loved the stunt work, but found the story of the sequel less interesting than the first. Yeah, I can see that. Design for Living. Really enjoyed this pre-code romantic comedy from Ernest Lubitsch. I also watched a couple of movies from Criterion Channel's post-apocalyptic sci-fi collection they added this month. The Day the Earth Caught Fire really impressed me about how bleak it was. Loved the ending. Finally, Panic in Year Zero was fine, but not a very subtle movie about a family navigating a way to shelter in the wake of the sudden nuclear war. I appreciated the escalation of the father's panic and how he was willing to do more and more terrible things to ensure his family's safety. It was solid. That's the one with the, I watched that, Ray Milland and Frankie Avalon, that's right. Tracy writes, Casino Royale, Barbie, FNAF, Chicken Run 2, and Rocky 3. And I'm sure he watched all of those in their entirety. Thanks, Tracy. Robert Muggy writes, all Criterions. Todd Browning's The Unknown, Ken Russell's Mahler, and Seven from Ozu, Tokyo Story, Late Spring, Early Summer, Late Autumn, Floating Weeds, The Munetka Sisters, and The Only Son. Brian writes, first time viewing since mid-December, Godzilla Minus One, Death Toilet Number Two, no thanks to my wife, Rebel Moon, Maestro, The Killer, The Day Trippers, which he deemed 100, I guess 100%, and Barbie. David writes, Maestro, A Good Person, My Man Godfrey, The Philadelphia Story, Equalizer 3, L.A. Confidential, and A Christmas Story. Terry writes, To the Wonder, The American Buffalo, Episodes 1 and 2, Ken Burns documentary, Repeat Performance, and The Lady in the Lake. Austin, Medium Cool Podcast is coming back. I'm going to be on it very soon to discuss my top 10, so be on the lookout. 2 weeks worth from Austin. Ikuru, The Iron Claw, Saltburn, The Holdovers, Kokomo City, Uncle Buck, Paranorman, Anatomy of a Fall, Tommy Boy, Dumb and Dumber, The Color Purple, Coneheads, Ace Ventura When Nature Calls, Fargo, The Tall T, Groundhog Day, Wayne's World, Dream Scenario, The Killer, Theater Camp, and All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt. Tony writes Elmer Gantry, The Blue Gardenia with the Nat King Cole cameo, Superman, and Spartacus. Kevin writes Asteroid City. Bill writes Adam's Ribs and Gangs of New York and Saltburn. It was an eclectic week. Zachariah writes 1001, Maestro, and Enya's Men. Adrian writes Vertigo, Rear Window, and A Place in the Sun. I'm sorry, that's the finally, but I do want to add, Bill chimed in, I go back and forth between Vertigo and Rear Window as my favorite Hitchcock film, and on some occasion it's North by Northwest, to which Adrian responded, tough choice, but Grace Kelly and Thelma Ritter tipped the scales for me. Adrian also writes, I want to play every part Thelma Ritter, Shelley Winters, or Lainey Kazan ever had. And yes, that includes the go-go dancer in the Frank Sinatra film, Lady in Cement. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to watch some fun films, some good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Yes, I will. Let's raise a glass to Glynis Johns, who passed away at age 100. Got an Academy Award nomination. I forgot about The Sundowners. I might have to revisit that with Deborah Carr and Robert Mitchum. And we go all the way back. Credits go back to the 1938. Films like The Fugitive and The 49th Parallel. This Man Is Mine, An Ideal Husband, The Great Manhunt, Island Rescue, No Highway in the Sky, The Promoter, Personal Affair, Rob Roy, The Highland Rogue from 1953, Helen Mary McGregor, Young and Willing, Land of Fury, The Beachcomber, Mad About Men, Josephine and Men. She was Mae Jean in The Court Jester, of course, Around the World in 80 Days, All Mine to Give, Shake Hands with the Devil, The Spider's Web. I mentioned The Sundowners from 1960. Did a slew of TV going into from the 1960s on. Mary Poppins, of course, is Mrs. Banks. Dear Bridget. Oh, that's right. She was on an episode of Batman. That's right. Dear Bridget. Brigitte. Three Dangerous Ladies. Mrs. Amworth. Going into the 80s, and her. That's right. She was Rose in The Ref, Zelly and Me, and her very last credit, she was Grandma in the Molly Shannon film Superstar. Yes, an SNL sketch made into a film back in 1999. So anyway, send in the clowns, please, and salute to Ms. Johns. All right, so go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. No film sociology next week. Mrs. Sosi and I are going to be attending a theater conference all next week, so it's just not happening. So we will do this again next week with 2 weeks of grabbing a pencil. So happy new year and happy birthday to film sociology, and we'll just keep going. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan. Hey, Kobe. Hey, Bianca. I miss you already.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
No. We'll do it live!